the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Citizens of heaven. And so if we take a look over at our awesome painting on the side there, Derek, John and Ruth took us through three talks looking at the new birth, actually becoming Christians for the first time, living holy lives, and then our third from Ruth, what it means to be a royal priesthood. So you could say in our first three talks, focused on right at the top of the screen, we've been kind of doing blue sky stuff. We've been looking at being citizens of heaven. And Johnny Baker last week brought us crashing back to earth, and we are now very much doing hands in the grass stuff. We have both hands full of soil, and we are doing earthy things. So Johnny brought us back to take a look at what it means to be residents of earth, and in particular, what it meant to be a citizen and a worker. So I hope as you're looking at this image, and it's so helpful to illustrate this series that we've been going through, 1 Peter, I hope now as you're looking at it and taking it in and absorbing it, you're not thinking this is a 50-50. I'm not thinking I'm half my time citizen of heaven, half my time resident on earth, as if you were kind of standing one leg in the resident on earth camp and one leg in the heavenly citizen camp. It's in fact much bigger than that. And it turns out that all of our heavenly citizenship in no way minimizes our earthly involvement, the stuff we get to do here and now. And once again, it all kind of hinges on that that verse that's on the front of our term card. Do you remember it? That's 1 Peter 2, 11 to 12. Dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles to abstain from sinful desires which wage war against your soul. And then our key bit, this is the interface between being a citizen of heaven and a resident of earth. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. So I hope today as we take a look at 1 Peter in chapter 3, we will we'll begin to see that being a citizen of heaven in no way minimizes our earthly involvement. If anything, it intensifies it. And we're going to get more involved with hands in the grass stuff as well as blue sky stuff. So one person who put this quite succinctly, and that's why I spoke to you about standing on one leg in the resident on earth camp or one in the heavenly camp, is a chap called Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And a quote from him is on the screen at the moment. He says, "Christians who timidly stand with only one foot on earth will also stand with only one foot in heaven." And I think what he's trying to get at here is to ensure that we have both feet firmly planted on earth. And if we do that, we'll also have both feet firmly planted in heaven. So if you'd like to grab one of those green books about shin height in front of you, and we are going to turn to 1 Peter chapter 3. So if it is your first time with us today, you'll also find right in the front of the little green book in front of you one of these orange little cards, or yellow actually. If you're looking to get more connected at Belmont, do fill one of these in and drop it off at the information point or even our welcome point to get connected. So we're looking at 1 Peter and chapter 3, which you can find on, one moment. On on page 1153 in the Church Bibles. Okay, so holding it there, before we read, let's just take a look at those bold headers that we've come through already in the series. So if you've got the Bible in front of you here, flick one left to the beginning of 1 Peter. And we've got Derek kicking us off with praise to God for a living hope. Then John Allen talking about being holy as God is holy. And then Ruth was bringing us the living stone and the chosen people. And then Johnny last week, living godly lives in a pagan society. And that's what this is going to build on today. So in these sections, we've been fleshing out kind of what it means to live good lives amongst the pagans, what it means to live good lives as Christians out there in the world. And I hope you can see from the way things are stacking up that Peter is saying that it's in fact not bits of life that we have to live in this good, light-filled, Christ-like way, but it's the entirety of life, right from civic society, so empires, countries and states, how we are as a citizen of the United Kingdom, right through to the workplace, how you are at work, in your job, and then here today, what we're going to zoom in on is how being a Christian is to impact the home, that the smallest of all the structures, right from the superstructures like civic society and government, right through to that little structure of home. So when you go home and shut the door, what things are like there is going to have an impact on the world. So without further ado, let's get into our Bible reading today. So 1 Peter 3 and verse 1. Wives, in the same way, submit yourselves to your own husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as elaborate hairstyles and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. Rather, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For this is the way the holy women of the past, who put their hope in God, used to adorn themselves. They submitted themselves to their own husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him Lord. You are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give way to fear. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and heirs with you of the greatest gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. Well, I think you'll agree as we look down, we have a reasonably tough passage today. So let's, to help us out, more for my benefit than for yours, let's go 2 pages right to 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 19. Peter is going to show us his epically huge view of the Bible. I've got two little pointers here, one moment. There we go. And Peter's going to show us his huge view of the Bible. So let's just remember who he was. The chap writing our letter today was the Apostle Peter. He lived with Jesus, saw Jesus, touched Jesus, heard Jesus, did everything with Jesus. And he says in 2 Peter 1, verse 19, we also have the prophetic message, this little green book, as something completely reliable. And if anything, our translation here is potentially a little bit weak in comparison to other more like-for-like translations, which say something like, and we have something more sure. He points at his little green book and says, even though I was there with him on the mountain, I saw him, touched him, was there, lived life with him, he could still point to this little green book and say we have something completely reliable and something even more sure. So if at first glance that sounds absolutely outrageous to you, then you might want to get to ask some of those questions and find out what Christians believe about this little green book by heading to the Christianity course on Tuesdays. Tuesday evening, they kicked off last Tuesday for the first time. Don't worry, you don't need to have gone to them all in succession. You can turn up for the first time next Tuesday and ask potentially, what is it? Why do these Christians have such a high and crazy view of the Bible? So, that said, let's run back to our passage before we get too carried away. So it's evident here that Peter means to talk a great deal about marriage. And one of the first things that we could probably pull out is that marriage is this human institution. It sounds a little bit odd to our ears, but it's in this list of both the civic government, empires, and the workplace that Johnny went through last week. And then he comes to marriage. And I think Peter's point here is that marriage is not the sole possession of the church. It's something that's for the whole world, and yet Christians are to infuse it with good and with goodness and with light and with life. It doesn't necessarily belong to us, but is the world's that we're to infuse and be salt and light in. And so, that said, that emphasis could be pretty helpful as we see where things are heading in our society at the moment. There's huge changes coming up in the way that marriages are going to be looked at on a legislative level. So perhaps we'll be revisiting passages like this in future years, just to know that it's not necessarily our possession, but something that we're to infuse with light and life. So, that said, you can almost see I'm kind of trying to not get to that first line. It's so tricky. So we've got a tricky one, haven't we? Wives, in the same way, submit to yourselves to your husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behaviour of their wives. I would argue this is a fairly tricky passage, and I've got to be honest, I would quite like to tiptoe around it. But the Bible forces us not to. So as we're coming to it, let's maybe bear in mind, when we've got a tricky passage, there are some things we can do. We can get rid of worldly baggage, so things that we might be coming to this passage with that aren't necessarily a biblical worldview. We've picked up stuff from the world that we need to drop off. We can bring some historical context, which, by the way, is going to help us out later with elaborate hairstyles and jewellery. So don't worry if you have come in with a great haircut today. I'm not picking on you. And then finally, we can bring the checks and balances of the rest of the Bible, which is so key for coming to a passage like this. We're not just going to tear this one out, are we, and say, this is my idea of marriage. No, it fits in a book, and that book is strong and powerful and brings many checks and balances, particularly to husbands, for the passage that we read today. So, getting rid of worldly baggage. A particular person that I found very helpful for this is this lady here, Amy Orr Ewing. She is a Christian apologist at the Oxford Centre for Apologetics, and she has been very helpful for me in understanding this passage a little more. Now, my wife's name is Claire, and we listen most of the time to Radio 4, which makes us, I think, maybe a little bit odd. We went kind of straight from Radio 1 to Radio 4. You're meant to kind of splash around at Radio 2 for a little while, aren't you? But we just went straight there. It's great. They've got some good comedy stuff. And in particular, when the BBC are on belief stuff, they're actually on the point. It tends to be when they're doing other things and religion bears on that, that they completely fluff it. So, Beyond Belief, BBC Radio 4 series, had Amy Orr Ewing as one of the panellists, and they were all discussing the biblical character of Eve, and she was very much representing the Christian worldview on this BBC programme. And I pulled out a quote from her, because what she did was just to go back to the accounts in Genesis 3 and just make sure from the very foundations we get rid of this worldly notion. So this is us getting rid of worldly baggage, this idea that at its root Christianity is a system of patriarchy. It's not. It may have been written and happened in many different patriarchal contexts, but at its root it is not patriarchal. And what she says is this, so talking about Eve, rather than being a subordinate little woman, the first woman we meet in the Bible, Eve, has volition, intellect, moral accountability, and spiritual equality. And she picks out some even more things as well, which I wanted to just bring to us to help us get rid of this worldly baggage before we can take on board some of the stuff from our passage today. So not only are those things true of Eve, but she has a huge amount of autonomy. She has capacity to reason, to persuade. She comes to God in the same level, in the same way as Adam. She doesn't need Adam or the man as some kind of mediator. She comes to him individually. And not only that, she has this moral accountability and spiritual equality, exactly the same as Adam there. So, and even larger than this, if we read Genesis 3 and we're taking a look through it, we see that Eve is actually the recipient of this redemption promise. It's her children it's her offspring who are going to crush the serpent's head, who are going to destroy the devil. So effectively, if we take a look back at Genesis, this idea that Christianity is a system of patriarchy is complete rot. We have someone in the character Eve who has volition, intellect, moral accountability, the power to persuade, and spiritual equality. And we'll see some of those checks and balances in our passage today as Peter talks about wives as co-heirs of that great salvation. So hopefully this is a little bit helpful in removing worldly baggage, but we can also add some historical context. And you'll be pleased to know, in preparation for this, I've been reading a very dull book called Roman Wives and Roman Widows. It's hilarious when you order something like this to work. You get very strange looks. Roman Wives and Widows. I've been very helped by this New Testament scholar, Bruce Winter, and what he's done is bring to bear the context of the time on passages like this and the one we have here. So what he's trying to do is point out that Roman legislation, Roman philosophy, and the letters of the church all point to this idea of a very new woman appearing around the first century AD, a woman whose provocative dress and potentially quite loose lifestyle was something new to the Roman world, which bothered not only Roman legislation, but also there was concerns in the church that this kind of activity would also be brought in. And so this is the kind of thing that is going on around the time that Peter and Paul are writing stuff like this. So helpfully, he points out that if we have a look at verse 3, some of those very bizarre verses, your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as elaborate hairstyles, the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. So these items, they found out, were actually effectively the uniform of what it was to be the new woman, this sexually liberated, free, fiercely independent, anti-children kind of woman who was being brought up around and beginning to thrive in the first century AD. This was like her uniform. She wore gold jewellery, pearl earrings, and had braided hair. And the concern was that these kind of secular worldly trends would come flooding into the church. So, you'll be pleased to know that jewellery, pearl earrings, funky hairstyles are not necessarily inherently evil. That's a good thing to know from this passage, isn't it? But these had an almost iconic significance that was having an effect within the church. We even see this Roman governor called Seneca writing to his mum. He writes around 49 AD or something to that effect, and he writes these words to his dear old mum: "Unlike the great majority of women, you've never succumbed to immorality. The worst evil of our time, jewels and pearls, have not moved you." And it just goes to show the significance things like this had at that point in history. So hopefully I've reasoned enough with you that by reducing some worldly baggage, taking on some historical perspective, this stuff suddenly becomes a little bit more palatable to the ear, and we can let God's word permeate and come hit us. So 1 Peter 3 and 1 and 2 deals pretty much explicitly with a relationship between a Christian wife and an unbelieving husband. But it'd be good for us to point out at this stage, if you're single, this is not a week off. I think the general principle there is pretty clear. If you have a home life in which there are unbelievers, folks who aren't used to church, who wouldn't ordinarily call themselves Christian, then how you live at home matters. That's the thing that Peter is trying to say. All these things are stacking up from the empire right through to home. How you live at home matters. Now, that said, he has some very particular applications for life at home for a Christian wife and an unbelieving husband. And if that is you, if that is your situation, then I really hope that you know these verses are here, that you can draw on them as an encouragement and go back on them time and time again. And it can be a terrible symptom of this kind of crass, block-headed, over-evangelical culture that views a relationship of a Christian wife with an unbelieving husband as somehow second class or not a real marriage. Real marriage is between believers or something like that. That is absolute rot and completely false. And as we come to this to our passage today, we just need to take a look and just see that for these relationships where there's one of the partners is not a believer, there's the possibility for great joy and for great heartache. We got so many awesome stories in our own congregation of husbands and wives coming to know Jesus through the witness of the other spouse, and that is absolutely fantastic. And I look out and I can see people for who that is true. That's their case. But it also be worth bearing in mind that it isn't always happy endings, and there can be the possibility for great heartache. And the Christian church, our church, Belmont, is called to support both and to treat marriage as equal, no matter the beliefs of those who are in it. So whether it seems to be leading for you, if you're in this situation and it seems to be leading for you potentially to great joy, or it could be leading to great heartache, there are still some things you can know. You can know that God has written this this scripture for you. He knows your situation. You are known to him. You are precious in his sight. Verse 4. You're of great worth, and your life is of great worth in his sight. So let me just give a brief New Testament example of a family in that kind of scenario. You might all be familiar with a chap called Timothy. He has two letters in the New Testament named after him. He didn't write them, he received them. And Timothy has an extended family that we know a fair bit about in the Bible. You don't need to turn to it, let me just read this to you. 2 Timothy 1 and verse 5. Paul says to him, "I reminded of your sincere faith, which first lived in your grandmother, Lois, and then in your mother, Eunice, and now I'm persuaded lives also in you." So we know of this chap called Timothy. His mum's called Eunice, and his grandmother's called Lois. You're thinking, where is he going with this? He's completely off. Acts 16, verse 1 and 2, we find a little bit more about the family. I've put it up on the screen there. They go to Derbe and to Lystra, where a disciple named Timothy lived, whose mother was Jewish and a believer, and whose father was a Greek. So let's just slow down and take that one in. A disciple named Timothy lived there, whose mother was Jewish and a believer, but whose father was a Greek. And we know that the wife in this situation, she's called Eunice. She has a sincere faith. She's known to God. What do we know about her husband? All we know, he was a Greek. No name, no more information, nothing, absolutely nothing. If you're an unbelieving husband here this morning, don't let that be you. Or if you're a husband here and you're thinking, I might just jack this all in, don't let that be you. What it would look like for my scenario is Claire, my wife, was a sincere, godly woman. Her husband lived in Exeter. Don't let that be you. Let yourself be known to God. Well, as we move on, let's take a look at this inner beauty that Peter calls us all to. And I hope you can see the pattern here, that things are beginning to stack up. Remember, Johnny was speaking about empires and the workplace and how we're to be Christians in those. Then Peter today, he zoomed in and he said, today we're going to look at the home and see how to be a Christian there. And all these things are stacking up. And the root of them, where is the energy going to be found to live a good life amongst the pagans? 1 Peter 2:12. It's going to be found in this inner life, not in external adornment, but on the inside, when hearts are one to know Jesus better. And so you've got this, I think, this big stack building up. You've got the country, civic government, you've got the workplace, you've got the home, and all of these things are to be impacted for Jesus. And the only way they can happen is if the inner life of the Christian is warm and right with God, if there's stuff going on when no one else is around. So I think he calls us to, and wives in particular, to cultivate this inner beauty that isn't going to fade, but that lasts. Good example of this. My good friend Don, who's sat just there, we were chatting before the service. He said, I wouldn't recommend getting old. Things are fading. I'm less beautiful than I was before. I don't believe that for a second. But what's going on is a beauty isn't fading, but is rising and growing as we move on. So my conclusion on this is, for my wife, Claire, who I've married, I've got a wife who's going to get more beautiful. Awesome. This is fantastic. Beauty is in no way a bad thing, and this inner beauty is not to fade, but to grow and to flourish. After our little verse here in 1 Peter 3 and 4, he then goes on to 5 and 6. Let's just read those together. Rather, coming back to 3 and 4, your beauty should not come from outward adornment. Rather, it should be that of the inner self, this unfading beauty. And there was a further point I wanted to add here, just that we live in a world where destruction of the private life is well and truly underway. You are connected to the rest of the world via your phone, the internet, things like that, at all points in time. And Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, blogs, whatever it may be, are all encouraging you to turn this inner life into an outer one and show everyone what's going on the inside. So it's going to be quite a countercultural thing to shut the door and to work on and cultivate this inner life that, to be honest, not many people will see. Not many people are going to comment on. Not many people are going to say, "Cool, look at that gentle spirit. That really stands out." Not many people are going to see that, are they? But it's who sees it that matters. Let's have a look in verse 4. "Rather, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight." And it is this inner life viewed by one person, the person who matters, that we are to cultivate. Now, running on to 5 and 6, we have this awesome addition to what it means, means to be this beautiful, godly wife. And Peter adds to it fearlessness. Let's have a look in 5 and 6. I have very little wisdom to add on the point of Sarah calling Abraham Lord. The most I could think of was that at home we have very silly nicknames for one another, and that if Claire really wants me to do something, she'll invoke a rather stunning name for me. Simon won't go take out the rubbish, but a musketeer or a prince will. Take that as you will. I've really got no more. verse 5 and 6. "Like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him Lord, you are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give way to fear." Fearlessness as a ground for someone being attractive, that's cool. That's really cool. If you were out there looking for a partner, could you really say you were looking for someone who was good and fearless? And that is what is something that's being called and asked for from the godly wife. And that immediately calls to mind for me Proverbs 31. There's this great literature about what it means to be a godly wife. In fact, one of the nicknames for Claire I had, I need to use it more, but back when we were first going out, I'd occasionally call her Proverbs 31, which was a goodie. I need to pick that up again. But 1 Peter 3 and 6 raises this idea of Proverbs 31, this woman who laughs at the time to come. She evidently has this belief in a sovereign God and is happy to laugh at the time to come because she is known by him and is safe in his hands. Then finally, our last point today, all these checks and balances that are going to colour, I said, didn't I, drop worldly baggage, take on board historical context. Another thing we need to bring with us, the rest of the Bible. And I think 1 Peter 3 does a great job of checks and balances on these verses. So husbands, and this is where it gets kind of scary for Christian husbands. So there's no directions for how to be a Christian governor. There's no directions for how to be a Christian emperor. But there's very clear, direct, and a little bit scary directions for being a Christian husband. Let's read it together. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives. Treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. And I love this, as it clearly, evidently shows God's fatherly care for wives. It won't be too hard for most of you to imagine. Imagine you're a dad. You have a little girl. That's not hard to imagine either. There's so many little heartbreakers around at Belmont. And imagine someone harms your little girl. You can feel the rage rising. There are very unchristian things that you would want to do to whoever harms your little girl. And one of the things that you certainly would do is to cut off all lines of communication, sever them with whoever has harmed your little girl. And I think if we take that illustration and pass it up onto God the Father, if you're a Christian husband here today, you have one of his daughters entrusted to your care. Harm her, and all lines of communication are severed. Your prayers will be hindered. It's terrifying, isn't it? And this terrifying check and balance, I think, should be used in conjunction with something like at the beginning, something where we see wives submit to your husbands. He said, husband, you abuse that, you do that wrong, all lines are going to be cut and severed. You could even argue that the whole of the gospel has been arranged such that people would hear, be able to talk to God. And yet, if a Christian husband abuses this relationship, then all lines of prayer are severed. So, in conclusion, we are to be citizens of heaven and residents of earth. And I want to come back to our quote from the beginning, this chap Dietrich Bonhoeffer: Christians who timidly stand with one foot on earth will also stand with only one foot in heaven. And I hope and pray as we go through this series that we would be people who have both feet grounded here on earth. We'd be people with our hands in the grass as well as having blue skies above.